Although American Civil War and UK history is a hobby, there are small costs associated with running a podcast. So if you enjoy our content, please support the show. You can do this by pressing the support the show button or pressing on the link to buy me a coffee in the show notes. Thank you for your continued support. Daz, American Civil War and UK history. Cheers.
Hello everyone, I'm Daz and welcome to American Civil War and UK History Podcast. This presentation is available as a video on YouTube and as a podcast from wherever you get your podcasts from. And remember, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and TikTok, and I'm also part of the Unfiltered Historian team. So joining me today, I'm pleased to say, is a co-founder and editor-in-chief of Emergency War, Chris Makowski. Hello, Chris.
Daz, thanks for having me back.
And managing editor of Emergency War, Sarah K. Biley.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I want to just make an announcement right now. We're going to change Sarah's title. She doesn't know this yet. She's going to be the Emerging Civil War Overlord.
Wow.
I don't know if I like the sound of that.
It sounds like the almighty powerful, doesn't it? Yeah.
See, but any D-Day fan would be like, yes. You know, yeah.
So, that's true. I have been listening to some D-Day stuff. I hadn't thought of that.
Yep, so our ECW overlord, Sarah Kibar.
I just immediately thought of, you know, like the Darth Vader march and this very ominous, scary thing. I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. Oh.
At the symposium, maybe you could have entrance music.
Oh, no.
Who does not want to come into a room with the Darth Vader?
We could get smoke machines and everything. What about that? Yeah. Okay, so today we're going to discuss the history of Emerging Civil War, which turns 11 years old this year. Okay, Chris, let's start by telling us how you end up volunteering for the Park Service, which will lead you to meet your partner in crime, Chris White.
Sure. My daughter, Stephanie, who is now 28, when she was four, she fell in love with Stonewall Jackson and became a Stonewall Jackson groupie. So when she was six, she became friends with a couple of the historians down at the Jackson Shrine, today known as the Jackson Death Site, the site where Stonewall Jackson died. And so by the time she was 11, she wanted to actually start volunteering for the park, which is Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. And we live in Western New York. So here's this cute little Yankee girl who wants to come down the South, volunteer for the park. And the park historians were like, we were waiting for you to ask. So they set up this little internship for her. And I brought her down for 10 days. We stayed at the park and she would work one site and I would work a different site. And so she would have her own independent experience. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll paint signposts or, you know, whatever. And they're like, no, we'll teach you how to work at the information desk. And so that's kind of what got me started volunteering. And so she had such a good experience. I had such a good experience that we asked to continue. So once a month for, gosh, I would say, I think it was like six years, we would come down and on a Friday night, we'd work Saturday and Sunday, and then we would head back to New York, and we did that for years and years. In the course of that, I had the chance, like my first day behind the desk at Fredericksburg, I had the chance to work with one of their interns that summer, a kid named Chris White. Chris was a student at the California University of Pennsylvania, and he struck me as this really kind of quiet guy, and he was just kind of there, and there was a seasoned historian who was kind of running her mouth and knowing this and knowing that and just kind of being maybe a little big for her britches. And she was talking about, you know, I'm going to pass the guide test, blah, 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 at Gettysburg. And all of a sudden, Chris opened his mouth and he just started rattling off all the stuff that she had either gotten wrong or misstated or whatever. And it was, just, you know, my impression of this quiet guy was suddenly shattered by like, oh, man, this guy's like Encyclopedia Britannica of the Civil War. And so over the course of that that 10 days, he and I had worked together a couple times and became friends over the course of the summer. And as it turned out, we shared a room at Park Quarters, where Stephanie and I would be there one weekend and then hit out of that same room a couple of the other weekends that we weren't there. And so we just over time became friends. And our mentor at the park, Frank O'Reilly, suggested to Chris and I, like, you guys should publish something. You know, you're kind of, that's the next step for you guys as historians. And Chris is a great researcher, was not at the time a strong writer. I was a great writer and not at the time a strong researcher. So we pooled our resources and he kind of handled the bulk of the research and I handled the bulk of the writing. And that's how our publishing team got started, and we did a little piece for the Fredericksburg History and Biography Journal here in Fredericksburg. And that's what got us going.
Cool. And so the idea of the foundation of ECW and the story behind that, so that, again, that starts at the Jackson Monument site, is that correct? So tell us the story.
Yeah. So over the course of our time, Chris eventually became a staff historian at Fredericksburg. I started doing more contract work for the Park Service because once they discovered, oh, he's actually a writing professor with communication skills, they started having me do work writing content for the web, doing some publications for him and things. So, you know, we both kind of took separate tracks with the park, but still very complimentary. And one night, we were sitting on the porch at the Jackson Shrine, on the porch of the caretaker's house where our friend Jake Struhelka was living, and smoking beers and drinking cigars. That's how that works. Smoking cigars and drinking beers, and we should start up a blog. You know, like the three of us, maybe get a couple other of our friends that we liked, people whose work we respected and admired, and let's start a blog where there's a community of us that are contributing, and kind of create a platform for ourselves to share our writing. And so that's really, really where the idea of Emerging Civil War came up with. Jake came up with the name, and we put some feelers out to some contacts. I think there were seven of us to start. And we were just, you know, trying to get a couple things up a week, and we just grew from there.
Yeah. So was it easy to get some of these people on board? Because you've got a big concentration in that area of some very influential people with inside the history community, haven't you? Especially at Fredericksburg National Park.
It took a lot for us to branch out from that because, you know, so many of us at first were had connections to Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. It took us a couple years to find someone who was based in the West who could just kind of write posts about the West.
Yeah.
I mean, we could do it from the East, but, you know, we really wanted to kind of have our tendrils out with connections in a lot of different places so that, you know, we would be geographically spread out and be able to kind of, you know, something that's really important to us as public historians who are grounded in parks where there are battlefields, being able to walk the ground is a really important part of our own personal credibility about knowing these stories and knowing these battlefields and how that all relates. So we really wanted to kind of, you know, be able to tap into people with that sort of frontline experience who had that credibility that being on site offers. So it wasn't a theoretic thing. It wasn't a scholarly thing necessarily, although we wanted to hold ourselves to those similar sorts of standards. But the credibility really comes from being in the front line and, you know, sharing those stories that way.
Okay. And so you mentioned you started writing a few bits and bobs for the Park Service, but so you actually write two books, don't you, from another publishing company. Is that before Emerging Civil War? Is that during the foundation of Emerging Civil War?
And there was actually a third book to that series, the first edition of The Last Days of Stonewall Jackson. And those were written as part of a book series for Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. The Friends of Fredericksburg Area Battlefields funded those. The park itself offered its stamp of approval. And Chris and I had access to park resources to be able to, you know, pull sources together to create those two books, and as well as Last Days of Stonewall Jackson. You know, and then that all just sort of, I'll be kind about it and say that it fell to pieces. The publisher was not as upfront about some of the publishing arrangements, and most of it was all a gentleman's handshake, and the publisher took some liberties and took some advantages that unfortunately didn't work. So Chris and I actually had a fourth book teed up for that about the Battle of Fredericksburg. And that's the book then was like, okay, well, we're not going to work with this publisher anymore. And Chris literally called up Ted Savas and say, hey, we've got this book that's essentially done, and off we go. And so that became Simply Murder, the Battle of Fredericksburg, which came out just in time for the sesquicentennial of the anniversary of the battle in December of 2012.
And so Ted Savas was heavily involved in like the preservation in the beginning in that area as well. So again, how did you guys actually meet So it was Chris that knew Ted, was it? Or did you know Ted as well?
We had a contact with Ted already because he had agreed to publish our hardcover Chancellorsville's Forgotten Front, The Battles of Second Fredericksburg and Salem Church. And so that book was already slated for release in May of 2013, time for the anniversary of those battles. And so we'd already had a relationship with Ted as a publisher, and Chris called him up and said, hey, you know, we've been doing this book series for the park. We'd like to just bring the whole series over to you. And we've got the first book ready to go. At that point, Ted really hadn't seen those first three books, but he knew of our work through our hardcover. But he also knew that the blog was pretty well branded by that point. He said, you guys are you know, recognized and recognizable. I think you've, you know, we're at the beginning of something really long-term and successful here. Let's give this a whirl and see how it goes. And so he really, you know, jumped on the opportunity to publish that first book. And I think that was a huge step for us as an organization to go from a strictly digital entity to something that then had a more traditional a print arm to it.
Yeah. And again, your books are very sort of battlefield friendly as well. That's what's great about them, because they're not, you know, they're not huge, but then you've got your maps, you've got, you know, so many elements. So I'm going to bring Sarah in now. Sarah, you are on the podcast. Sorry about that. So explain what steps are taken, because you've written a book for Emergency War. What steps are taken in the writing process of getting a book to, you know, to the publisher eventually?
Sure. Well, I would venture to say that different authors are going to have different writing journeys. But as far as the publishing journey with the Emerging Civil War series, it's important to make sure that the idea is pitched, that it's been vetted, that both the editors of the series and the publisher are in agreement. I know for one project I've worked on, I had to really provide some background on how I felt like the title will be able to sell and that there's a market for it, because you want a market for the books. And that's important when you're choosing the topics and areas to be explored. And we're to the point in the series where we're also starting to look and we're like, okay, what battles have we missed? Where do we need to go back and fill in? And there's certainly a few, if you're looking down the title list, that will need to be filled in and might already be in the works. So the topic is chosen, and then, like I said, everyone's going to have a little bit of a different writing process. For me, I was in California when I was doing the research and writing for Call Out the Cadets, The Battle of New Market, which is mine that has been published thus far. And so I made a research trip out to Virginia, spent time at Virginia Military Institute and some other archives, quite a few days on the battlefield, as Chris said, really getting to know the ground. I call it the boots on the ground approach. You want to see where the rises are in the land and, you know, ask the questions, you know, go out with the knowledge that we have, but then really look at the terrain and see what's going on. And at that same time, I was doing the research so that I could write the driving tour for the book. I was making notes that I would need for working with the cartographer to get the maps done, and a lot of other details. So one of the things that's really important is to look at all the components of the Emerging Civil War book, because there are things that go across the brand. You know, our maps are very distinctive. We always do the driving tour or some sort of touring notes. Lots of pictures, so taking pictures along the way and research is important, and things like that. And for me, since I was living on the West Coast at that time, I had to do a lot of it kind of all at once. I think for others in the area, you know, they've maybe planned trips to certain areas of their battlefield and photographed it in certain seasons or those sorts of things. And then a lot of it is just sitting down and writing and getting the manuscript done, then getting the photo captions written up, making sure we've got all the citations ready to go. We don't publish foot or end notes in the books themselves, and that's because we want the book to flow quickly and not kind of get bogged down with those. But the books do have the footnotes or endnotes available online, so you can always follow up and see where we were getting quotes or ideas or those sorts of things as well. So collecting all of that together, and then Chris Makowski has like a guideline of your packet that you're supposed to have all together when you submit your manuscript. And some authors are better about it than others. I would like to think I did okay, but it's honestly been a while and I don't remember all the details on that one.
You were fine. You were great.
So So what happens at that point is then it's going to be reviewed by a historian in the group to make sure that historical details are good, the interpretation, even if it's new and emerging ideas, is well researched. And then it will go to someone who's going to do copy editing and content editing. So that's making the book flow well. A big one is getting rid of passive voice. And then we start working with our proofreaders. That'll go through a couple rounds of proofreading. Savas Beatty designs the cover. They also pick most of the titles, although the authors get a little bit of a say in there. And then, you know, it goes through the publishing process, and everything that Savas Beatty has lined out, and their team will reach out with questions, with marketing ideas, things like that along the way. So, and Chris, you've published much more than I have, so if you want to jump in on this, please do. But I think every book has a little bit of a different story of how it evolves and how it comes together. But at some point, it's going to meet that standard list and have to meet the requirements of the series.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And the idea for the books really came about because, you know, as Chris and I were given tours at Fredericksburg or at Chancellorsville, you know, people would go on a tour where you've got, you know, 35 minutes to tell the story of the Battle of Fredericksburg. You know, you really can only tell so much of it in broad strokes in that period of time. So people have to go, oh, that's really interesting. Is there a book I could read that would kind of tell me more about this? I mean, that was fascinating. Well, you know, at the time, the only books on the shelves were, you know, 350-page books that were $35 or $40. And great books, but not necessarily something the casual visitor wanted to read as their first blush. So we really wrote these books to fill that niche, to answer that question, you know, is there a book I can read to tell me a little bit more about this? So the books are intended to be really reader-friendly, lots of pictures, lots of maps. That's why originally there were no endnotes or footnotes of the books, because that's not the audience. You know, those weren't the people who were picking up these books. We got a lot of clamor from Civil War hardcore buffs who were like, I want some footnotes. And I think it was, you know, so we decided to put those online to take advantage of our digital presence. So we weren't taking away from pages of the book that are really geared for those casual readers, but any hardcore fan who wants them, they're still available, you know. So the first several books don't have those footnotes, but since then we have started publishing them online. And then, you know, people will be like, oh, well, they're not really in the book. And I tell those people to go fly off a kite, or, you know, fly off a cliff, jump off a kite, you know, whatever your metaphor was. And, you know, because like they're there, you're just being, you know, kind of pretentious about it at this point. You know, the thing that has been most rewarding about the whole series for me, and, you know, we're up to, I think, 45 books now, is that Ted basically has given us carte blanche to do this book series. And, you know, for writers to have that sort of creative control over their own product is something that's almost unheard of. So our organization vets the manuscripts. We do all the fact checking, all the peer review. The books are peer reviewed. And so we do all of that stuff in-house. We do all the design and layout in-house. Savas Beatty helps us with some of the structural things like copy editing and proofreading. They do all the marketing. But we've got a tremendous amount of creative control over this series, which I think is a real testament to the faith that Ted has shown us over the years.
Yeah. And I want to point out to the audience, if you're new to ECW, is this is all done voluntary by everyone, isn't it? You know, this is the thing. You guys have also got full-time jobs as well, you know, so I just wanted to point that out. It's a full-time job on its own, isn't it? Let's be honest.
At least for me and for Sarah, we really essentially have two full-time jobs. We've got each have a job that pays the bills, and then we've got this other job, and we do treat it like a job. It's more than just a hobby. It's more than just a passion project, because we firmly believe in that idea of helping to promote emerging voices in the field and giving them a platform to have their voices heard, to have their work shared, to have their ideas discussed. We want to do for those people who are coming up the same thing that was done for us, that Frank O'Reilly, for instance, did for Frank and I, for Chris and I, you know, help them out, show them the way, give them the boost, share some great ideas.
Yeah. And again, you're a springboard, aren't you, for this young talent that's coming up, or talented writers, you know, and it's great to have that for them, you know, because where would they go before that, you know? That's the thing, isn't it?
And you know, and Sarah is a great example of that. And, you know, Sarah, you can kind of speak to that journey, but, you know, she's someone we put out a solicitation for guest posts. If you've got something you want to write, you know, send it in. We'll take a look at it. We'll help you out. And Sarah responded to one of those calls. And now today she's the overlord of Emerging Civil War. So things can happen.
And also, you know, you've put some of them on Audible as well, in audio versions. Can I just make a little request, Chris? Can we have the Chances of Ill Forgotten Front on the audiobook one day, please?
Send that to Ted, you know.
Okay, yeah. Is that Ted's
idea? It's an older book. The chances of that getting to the front of the queue are a little smaller.
I can imagine with the amount of work you guys have got. Okay, yeah, so that's cool. So recently you've got a book series, 10th anniversary book series, which is quite important. So there's been a lot of work gone into that, hasn't there? Where are you as far as along the process of that?
Well, Sarah's actually pulling a book together right now. So you want to talk about that a little bit, Sarah?
Sure. So the one that I'm working on right now is Western Theater. So the idea with the 10th anniversary series is we wanted a way to be able to put into printed published form some of the very best blog posts that have been on the Emerging Civil War blog in the 10 years of ECW's history. So there have been a variety of topics chosen. There will probably be 9 or 10 books in the series once it is finished. And it really brings together a lot of different voices. The goal with each of the books is to work around the theme that's given. So some that are currently available, we have the Summer of 63 Gettysburg, we have Summer of 63 Vicksburg, the Grant and Lee book, which is basically the overland campaign through Petersburg and Appomattox, is also available, and we've got others releasing soon. So bringing together blog posts around those topics written by a lot of our authors, some of our guest authors. There's even some new material that hasn't appeared on the blog before in the books. But it's an essay collection is the easy way to think of it. But they're short, they're readable. I think there's probably about 30 articles per book. Does that sound about right, Chris?
Yeah, more or less. And because the length of some of them depends, you know, so.
Right. But it's been a really interesting way to bring together all the different types of talent. So some of the books will have transcriptions of a podcast that we've done. Others will be featuring the beautiful photography that you can find on the blog. And of course, the writing, which is such a key part of the Emerging Civil War brand.
And the idea, Daz, really was, you know, when we first started as a blog, you know, there was a lot of digital content out there. And I think today the digital landscape has shifted more towards social. But, you know, the blog was sort of at the bottom of the food chain. And then you kind of moved up to magazine articles and then maybe a journal article or a book or something like that. And so, you know, blogs weren't taken all that seriously, but they had a lot of impact just because they reached a lot of people. But they weren't necessarily something that were taken seriously, except that after we got going, the editors of all the magazines started following us and started using us sort of as a place to test out new material. So if somebody then would submit to one of their magazines, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen your stuff on the blog. It's really good. And that kind of opened some doors that way. And so over the years, as the brand has really reinforced itself and really kind of established its credibility, it's not something that's just a little, whiz in the pan, because there is some really awful content out there. You know, I love digital media because it has democratized everything, which makes it easy for people to produce content. The problem is it makes it easy for anybody to produce content. And so, you know, that sense of credibility, the gatekeeping the editors used to provide isn't there. And so, you know, there's rightly so some skepticism about online content. Fortunately, I think that our brand is established well enough over 10 years that, you know, people do take it seriously now. And so to be able to kind of collect all that into published form, and people have updated those blog posts and added some footnotes and those sorts of things, just been kind of a nice way to commemorate that journey from, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around on a porch drinking beers to something that, you know, we get thousands of people who read the site every day.
Yeah, and not just in the US, all around the world. you know, which is amazing. You know, you've got that reach. And one of the reasons you have that reach, like you're just saying, is the website. And so how was that adapted and grown over that period of time? Because obviously in 2000, and was it 2011? It started the website, is that right? Yeah, so you know, it sounds strange, but 11 years ago, the internet was a different world.
Oh, yeah.
And it changes so quickly now, as you know. So how has that sort of, like, you know, changed over time, you know, with the sort of stuff that you're doing via the website?
I have to say, before we start talking about the website, I should start singing the Darth Vader theme so that Sarah, because this is Sarah's realm, so now we're going into
Let's go to Sarah.
Dun, 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 dun. Well, Sarah sweeps in and talks about them.
Well, this is actually an area that we are working to step up our game. The blog that you see, the website that you see online right now, serves its purpose with hosting the content that is produced every day. I mean, we're posting 2 to 3 blog posts every day. And those are being shared. We have a great social media team that is helping to highlight some of the blog posts and a lot of the content that way as well. But one area, and this has been under discussion for a number of years, one area that ECW has an opportunity to kind of advance and grow a bit is making our website more user-friendly, updating it. Those who know website structure and looks, if you're seeing what's on the slide right now, if you're watching this on YouTube or somewhere, you'll see, oh, that looks a little bit old school, and we completely recognize that it is. And I'm excited to announce that this summer we're doing some website work. We're working with some professional designers, and hopefully later in the year we're going to be unveiling a new look on the site. You'll still be getting all your content, but we're hoping to make it a bit easier to find, a bit easier to direct people to all the features that we offer. But if you're looking at the site right now, I mean, we have our blog, which sits on the homepage. We have the about page, which if you're looking at that, it then expands into our editors, our authors. We see our 2022 symposium, which is coming up in August. There's publications, which there again, it expands into these huge pages where you can see all the books that Emerging Civil War has published in their couple of different series. We have information about our podcast, our speakers bureau, which is how we help connect our members with audiences looking for history speakers. The contact page, there's so much information on here. And the website serves its purpose, like I said earlier. And for a while, there was the thought of, well, let's not reinvent the wheel. But we're kind of getting to the point where structurally and with technology, we need to update the wheel a little bit. So that's going to be coming here pretty soon. In just my time that I've been with Emerging Civil War, we have added many more pages to the website, and not all of them are visible when you first glance at it. But with so many books coming into the series, every book has its own page. All of our authors and editors have their own biography page. There is a lot of content that has to get managed on the back end of the website. And sometimes we're able to kind of make group projects of that and get some help updating and managing it. But it's a lot to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And again, like you're saying about the book. So not only are you, you know, editing all these books and stuff, you've got to, like you said, three posts a day you're putting up, blog posts and stuff like that. And then you've got the podcast, and then you've got this, that, and the other. Is that difficult to run? Is that, you know, because how many people are actually involved in that process?
Well, we have about 30 members, correct me if I'm off on my numbers there, Chris, and everyone's involved to some extent. I would say those that serve on our board and a few of our other members that are in more of leadership roles do a lot of the work, but I want to give credit to everyone who's doing writing and helping out in various ways. There is a lot of work that falls on a few people, and that is one thing that we've been working on in this past year, is a little bit of leadership restructuring to help with spreading out the workload.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, with 30, I think there are 34 of us right now, and that just requires traffic management. And Sarah, one of her key responsibilities is just to kind of balance the schedule and, like, what do we have in each of our slots, and are the days covered, and we want to make sure nobody's posting over each other. And so just, you know, kind of keeping the schedule flowing smoothly is a challenge with 30 some people. And so Sarah admirably does that. And, you know, really kind of keeps things moving on a day-to-day basis. I mean, we're up to about 7,200 posts. And if you divide that by 11 years, that's 654 posts a year. It's a tremendous amount of content. And so one of the things we're doing with this website restructuring is just to try to make those archives more accessible so that, that people can find that great content over time and be able to have it at their fingertips. It's kind of cool. If you search for a lot of Civil War topics, we'll show up on that first page of search results, often in the top three for some post that's been on the site for a while. And so, you know, just helping people access that information, I think, is really important for us.
Yeah, it definitely helps, you know, people like myself when I'm putting a podcast or something together. You know, there's always that real rich source of information out there. And again, you guys contribute massively to that, you know. So anyway, going back to you, Sarah, obviously, like Chris mentioned earlier, your opportunity come from sending in guest posts, you know. So do you want to just talk a little bit about that, about your, you know, how you then become a managing editor? Obviously, you're on the editing board, but now you're obviously overlord, you know. So, yeah, just tell us a little bit about that.
So how did I become the overlord?
Yeah.
It's not quite as dramatic as one would hope. So I had been reading the Emerging Civil War blog for about a year to 18 months. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in guest posting and writing with us, don't wait a year, but go back through our archives, read content, get a feel for like the type of articles that Emerging Civil War likes to post. And we've got all different styles of articles. And so I've been reading the blog for a while, and I can remember telling my mom one day, I was telling her about this blog I was reading. I was reading lots of history blogs at the time and doing some stuff on a website of my own. I remember telling my mom, if I ever was going to guest post for someone out of all these blogs I'm reading for, Emerging Civil War just seems really real. They seem approachable. And, you know, I made comments on posts and got a little bit of interaction with some of the authors. And it was in the spring of 2015 that I submitted my first guest post. And the editorial committee at the time sent it back to me, I think, three times. They were making me rewrite it. And, you know, I would make the revisions they asked for, send it back in, and then they come back with some more. And what was happening was I was coming from a historical fiction background. And although I was writing factually, I had too much fiction mixed into my article. So they were making me strip it out. And I go back and I read that article sometimes, and there's things I'm like, oh, that's cringy. I believe little bit embarrassed about some of the ideas I had and was putting forward and how I presented it. But the article published on May 8th, 2015, and I was trying to remember who I communicated with. It might have been Dan Davis, who was doing a lot of blog management at that time. But anyway, was communicating with one of the editors, and he invited me to continue writing. So I submitted a few more posts in the fall of that year. And it was in December 2015 that they asked if I wanted to be a member. And I was so excited and joined. And then over the next year or two, I was asked to help with reading guest posts as an editor. Then things kind of changed. And then I was running the editorial committee. And then for a while, Dan Davis and I were co-managing editors. And when he went to take a job at American Battlefield Trust, it kind of fell to me as sole managing editor. So it was a bit of a default. It was a bit of being the one there doing the work, I'm afraid. So maybe not as glamorous as one wants to think it would be. But it's been a good journey, and it's about continuing to make a good experience for everyone who's in the group, who's been here much longer than I have been, or who is brand new, and, you know, helping to give them a good experience, a good journey, as they are hopefully building their voice, building their writing talent in the history field. And that's something that I'm really passionate about. And when we get together and we have either board meetings or, you know, our group retreats or things like that, that's something that I'm always looking at. How can we make this a better experience all the way around? How do we make the brand stronger? But how do we never lose focus of we're here to help the people working with us?
And I don't want to let Sarah sell herself short there, because she wouldn't have been in that position doing that job by default, quote unquote, if she didn't have the skill to do it in the first place. That's always one of the things for me is that I think is an important challenge, is matching up people with their skill sets and their interests. And I mean, we've got a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done to run the organization, done by a few people. We're always looking for volunteers, and there can be the temptation to cram a round peg into a square hole. But it's really about matching up the people and their interests and their long-term goals for themselves with the jobs that we need to have done. So, you know, just because we have a job that needs done doesn't mean we're going to cram somebody in there. We really want to help people. When we tell people when they kind of sign on, use your experience with Emerging Civil War to help you achieve the goals you want to achieve. Leverage the power of our brand in ways that help you get where you want to go. So that, you know, if someone wants to develop editorial skills, or someone wants to print a magazine article, or someone wants to eventually get a book deal, or give tours at a particular place, how can you use Emerging Civil War as a way to cultivate the skills and background that you need to get you where you want to go? And, you know, it's a really core part of our mission. So, Sarah showed aptitude early, and it's really been a wonderful experience from my point of view to see her develop as a writer, as an editor, and as a mentor now to help people also along their paths.
And that's something that, again, coming back to why do I do what I do? It has been such a wonderful learning experience. And I got so much mentorship with writing, and, you know, I'm still getting mentorship. Something came up the other week and I needed some advice, and I reached out to a fellow member and said, hey, this is a situation that I'm dealing with. You know, what would be your advice handling it professionally? And he very graciously, you know, gave me some wonderful advice. And, it's been important for me to have that as a community. And I can honestly say I wouldn't be where I am professionally today without Emerging Civil War. And as my journey professionally continues, I want to make sure that I'm helping the next set of members coming up and making sure they have similar good opportunities. And as Chris said, helping to match the interests of members to areas where they can take ownership and be able to run with that project. And we can kind of sit back and watch it develop. It's been interesting in the last year or two. We've had some newer members, and, you know, I've been able to go to Chris Makowski and say, I think this person would be a really good fit for this job. And sometimes it works out really well. And, you know, sometimes maybe it wasn't the right fit, but it helps us learn more about that person and where we can help them out next.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And, okay, then, so let's talk about the social media side of things, because that is where, you know, it's where things are going, isn't it? You know, so when was the decision to make, and you had to make this decision to go to the social media side of things and push it from there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we started, you know, as soon as we started the blog, we started up a Facebook page. But how we've been using that, how we've been using Twitter, that has definitely evolved over the years. There have been times where we've had content specific to our social media channels, and at times just sort of using it to amplify what we've got going on in the blog. The blog will always be our bread and butter. How we use the other social is a lot different. But and Sarah can speak to this a lot more intelligently than I can, because she has helped manage and coordinate some of that social. But I think that, you know, when you say it's where it's at, the digital landscape today is a lot different than it was when we started. I don't know that we would, if we were to start Emerging Civil War today, that it would be a blog. It might be a social group like, you know, Unfiltered Historian, for instance.
Yeah.
And the challenge there is that there is a tremendous number of, you know, social media groups that are out there.
Yeah.
Sharing content, creating content. And, you know, what makes one different from the other? What are the professional standards? Or, what's different between the practice of history and just sort of talking, you know, or commentating about history? I think it's a really complicated environment for any historian who's working in the in the social sphere right now. And I think the other thing too is, in, you know, Twitter in particular is just a hot mess for history.
It is a frustrating place for me.
It can get toxic quickly. So I've just made the choice to not be in that space, you know, for good or for ill. It doesn't, there's no value added for me. So I've stayed out of it on a personal level. Yeah. But, you know, Sarah, you can speak more intelligently to some of that stuff than I can.
Sure. So in the time that I've been with Emerging Civil War and helping out in leadership, I think we kind of have to go back and credit a former member. His name was Todd, and he really started taking Emerging Civil War social media to another level. At least he was the first that I was aware of who really started developing a strategy and working with it. And he left us on good terms, friendly terms, but his job was taking him in a different direction, so he didn't have as much time to be managing our social media, but I do want to give credit to him for really helping to begin launching us toward the levels that we're at today. And right now we have a wonderful social media team. Paige Gibbons-Bacchus heads it up, and she has several other folks who work with her, and you know, they are really faithful about making sure that the content goes out and that they're keeping it as current as possible with what's coming out on the blog. And I'm very appreciative of that. To be honest, it's not a department that I have worked really closely with because they're doing a great job. It's not an area that I constantly have to check on or kind of micromanage, which I greatly appreciate. I do think as we are launching the new look on the website and things like that, there'll probably be some discussions, some strategy meetings and those sorts of things moving forward. But it's been wonderful just to see the reports from Paige and her social media department about how it's growing, how interactions are going. And one thing that I do want to just emphasize and give credit to our social media folks is this has happened organically. So we have not gone out and bought subscribers, or we have not run a lot of ads or anything like that. So we're really getting, it's building a network of people that are genuinely interested in the content. And I think that is a wonderful thing to see. And I give a lot of credit to our social media department. They certainly deserve it.
Yeah, definitely. And that moves us on to YouTube, Chris, because so when was the decision to, so one of your, because you did quite a few videos at the beginning, didn't you? So did you always have your selfie stick with you? And I was kicking myself at the weekend because I never took mine away. I left it at home. And I met Winston Churchill. And yeah, but anyway.
it's one of those things that I just started doing them because I felt like it. So there was no real strategy to YouTube other than, let's see how this goes. I, for my own purposes, wanted to learn how to edit video on my phone. And so that became sort of my opportunity to do so. So I've really tried to keep those kind of low key, try to keep the production values on them pretty simple. If you compare them, for instance, to videos that we do with the American Battlefield Trust, which are high end, high quality, high production, you know, and I think this ties back to something Sarah said earlier about how Emerging Civil War feels very accessible, you know, and I want the videos to feel like they're accessible. One of the things that I think is one of the greatest compliments that gets paid to us at the symposium is people come up to us and say, like, I can't believe how accessible you guys are. I feel like I know you guys. I feel like I can go out and talk to you guys. And so everything we do, I really like to have, I like it to have that authentic feel to it. So I think the videos are just sort of an extension of that. I get to go to cool places and see neat stuff and talk to interesting people. So if I can get them to do it on camera and I've got a minute to do it, then I'd like to be able to just share that experience with viewers.
Yeah. And then that leads on to the podcast side of things, sort of, doesn't it? Because it sort of goes hand in hand. Is that right?
Yeah. And sort of, yeah, because you know, once I started recording the podcast using Zoom, it's like, well, I've got all this video, might as well put it up on the YouTube page as well. What seems like a different life, I started out as a radio guy, and every day I had a half-hour radio talk show where I had to interview somebody. So the podcast really just feels like my old days doing radio. So it's something that's easy for me, something I enjoy, something I've got the skill set to do. I don't know that the world needs another Civil War podcast, to be completely honest with you. There are a lot of people, again, digital allows people to do podcasts, and you know, it seems like there are podcasts coming out of people's wazoos at this point.
Yeah, so there's podcasts about everything now, I think.
So do we need another one? I don't know, but I'm having fun doing them, and so when I stop having fun doing it, maybe I'll stop doing the podcast.
Yeah. I know what you mean. And I can't comment because I'm in that business myself. So.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
And I think it's important. I'd just like to jump in here. In I think the YouTube channel and the podcast are an area where we have a member or maybe a few members who are interested in doing that. It's something they're wanting to develop as a personal skill. So, you know, that's an area that it's developing that way. We may not be putting concerted group effort into it, but we've had those discussions and we've said, you know, at this time we want to keep our focus in X, Y, and Z direction, but these other things, they're good. They, you know, they fit in with the brand. It's fine. And I think that's a really good thing to have happen, is letting members pursue what's interested to them, but also, and again, we regularly have conversations about this, defining how much of that interest, what percentage of the brand energy, if you will, is going to get devoted to that. And that's something that we're always weighing in the balance.
Mm-hmm. The other thing too is that the podcast particularly is not just a content creation tool, but it's a marketing tool as well. I mean, I pretty much try to keep the focus of our podcast content on our authors, the projects they're working on, or in some instances, our partners. We have a lot of different partnerships. Our partnership with you, for instance, is something that's really important to us. Civil War Trails, American Battlefield Trust. So if one of our partners is doing something, Civil War Roundtable Congress would be another one. You know, I'll try to do interviews with them to promote what they're up to as well. But otherwise, I try to kind of keep it in-house so that we're talking about the things that we as a community of historians are up to, and the projects that we're doing, the things that are interesting and passionate to us and our areas of expertise. So one of the many ways that Emerging Civil War promotes the work of the historians who are part of our community.
Yeah. YouTube has been a massive influence on me as far as your channel, American Battlefield Trust. Well, like you said, that, you know, they do the more high-end stuff, but I mean, some of your videos are absolutely fantastic, you know. I mean, I went back watching some of the really old stuff the other week, you know, and it's fantastic stuff, you know, and it's actually been a big influence on me, you know, so I'd like to thank you for that, you know, because, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it's taught me a few things by watching them, you know, of how you do stuff and that, you know, and, yeah, and it's very popular.
Well, it's, and again, and I think Sarah would agree with this, we're privileged to be able to go to these places and see these things and talk to these people. And if we can share that with our viewers and our readers and our listeners, I think we have a responsibility to do that, because not everyone has that privilege, you know. No. Really blessed to be able to do that.
And that's what I love about it. I like to share it too, you know, that's the thing. I want to share it with other people because I'm so passionate about it, you know. And that gives me that tool, you know.
Yep.
Okay. Anything to add to that, Sarah, or was that it?
Oh, I don't think so. Thank you,
okay,
though.
Okay, cool. Right, okay, so let's move on to the 10th anniversary last year. So, Chris, did you ever think, you know, I mean, this must have been a real moment, you know, to reach 10 years. So in your wildest dream, did you think it would last that long?
I really no. I didn't. We got bigger, quicker than I thought we would. And Chris's wife, Sarah, God bless her soul for being so patient. When we turned 5, she said, not too bad for 3 idiots sitting on a porch. And to this day, I keep thinking, like, you know, we haven't done too bad for 3 idiots sitting on a porch. And it's because, you know, the 3 idiots have grown to, you know, more than 50 people over the past 11 years who've been in and put in some work in some capacity and have gone on to other things or are still with us or working in different capacities. It's a real huge team effort. And, you know, I think that's what's made it so successful.
Yeah. And okay, let's move on, because the symposium. So when was the idea of the symposium, and also why was it called symposium and not conference? Did you want it to sound different? Because it's the first time I've ever heard of something called a symposium, you know? So what was the idea behind that?
That was a Chris Waite idea. He had gone to several symposia, you know, as a young historian growing up. I think the Chambersburg Civil War Seminar was something that was really influential on him in the days that Ted Alexander ran that. And so he just thought it would be a good idea for us to have a conference of some sort. He came up with the idea to call it a symposium. It's not a bind to me. And so, you know, we're going on year 8 now. We've gone virtual for a couple of them just because of COVID. But, you know, Sarah, again, in her overlord capacity, is really the one of the two masterminds that's running the event now. And it's been neat to see the way it's grown.
Okay.
Overlord Byerly, anything to add?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest, because when I was still like on the outside, or, you know, just doing writing and such, I was really on the fence about the name Symposium. It conjured up certain scenes that we read about from Greek past, and I wasn't sure if that was a good thing or not. But I have come to really appreciate the word for it, or, you know, calling it that, because I think it represents the discussion of ideas, getting together and discussing. And yes, we have presentations, we have panels for discussion and things like that. But yet, one of my favorite things at the symposium is hearing our attendees, you know, talking amongst themselves or talking with other ECW members and just exchanging ideas. And it's not an event where the presenters are kept in a back room or are sitting at a table on their own. We really try to make it an event where there is discussion that happens. And so I've grown rather fond of the title, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And it makes you stick out, I think. Do you not think?
I'm sorry, Des.
It makes you guys stand out because it's something different.
Maybe.
I think our low price point probably makes us stand out compared to.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
The first year we did $55 a ticket just because, you know, brand new. Let's see how this goes. And we literally had people show up and say, like, you're not charging enough for this. And so, you know, we've really tried to keep it as inexpensive as possible, covering our costs. It is our only, you know, kind of our main source of revenue. We're a 501c3, so the revenue that we generate is pretty important for us. But we really try to keep it as inexpensive as possible because we want people to come together and have a good time and talk about the Civil War and enjoy the fellowship of being part of this community that we have created. And we have so many people who come year after year as return customers. Inevitably, like, we will announce on Saturday of our symposium this year, we'll announce next year's theme, and I'll bet you we'll sell a third of our tickets on the spot.
Yeah.
You know, because people are just, without even saying who's going to speak, you know, here are the dates, here's the topic, you know, and I say that because, like, we've created this community that people like to be a part of, and that accessibility, that contact, that camaraderie, I think is just invaluable.
Right. Yeah. And we're thankful for the loyalty of so many of our followers. It's really incredible to see. And I know some have become personal friends, not just of the brand, but of individuals, myself, Chris, you know, we look forward to seeing a lot of the folks who are coming. You know, we'll look at the list and go, oh, so-and-so's coming again. It's going to be so nice to see them and catch up.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the first one, Chris, because it was different. I know it's still what Spotsylvania. So firstly, how does it end up at Stevenson's Ridge? And then, you know, so how does it, because I've seen a few of the first ones, like, I think that you can watch some of the talks, and it's very intimate and very small, isn't it? Like, a lot smaller. So just tell us about the evolution of it going from, you know, one place to the net to the bigger building.
Sure. I married into the family and they had an event space.
Love it. You got earthworks, an event space, and garage doors, all in the same package.
I tell Jennifer that I love her for more than her earthworks. And that's true. you're looking at a picture of one of our event spaces. It's called the Riddick House. It's a plantation house that dates back to 1812. It comes from North Central North Carolina. And my father-in-law had disassembled it, brought it log by log to Spotsylvania, reassembled it, updated it, modernized it, and added an event space in the basement. And that's typically where Stevenson Ridge might rent that space out for bridal showers or baby showers, or, you know, small weddings, you know, like up to 7 people. And so they'd had actually had 2 Civil War symposia there in the past that Chris and I had spoken to. That's actually where I met my wife. So Chris said, you know, we should have our own symposium and let's see if we can do it at the Riddick House. And, you know, small manageable space held, you know, 75, 80 people. We're starting small, $55 a ticket. And we actually filled up the space and did pretty well. So the next year we actually oversold the space. It was pretty crowded in there. So the third year we decided to move part of the event over to the large event space on campus, which is called the Lodge, because a wedding had booked it for one of the days. There it is there. We could only have it for one of the days. So we had half the symposium in the Riddick House basement, half in the big space there. And ever since, we've been in the big space. And we can have up to 144 people with nice big round tables to sit at. So we're not crammed in metal chairs. Everybody's got space to spread out a little bit. And we intentionally keep it capped at that. We've had people say, like, you should move to a bigger space. You could sell more tickets. We've got a waiting list every year. And we've intentionally kept it at this size because we like the intimacy. We like the atmosphere. Honestly, we'll never get a better break for event space than what we get right now. And so lots of reasons why we'll keep it in this space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about the presentations because, you know, not only are you editing books and blogs and YouTube channels and Facebook and everything that goes with it. So when you decide that, you know, okay, right, this is our topic, how then do you decide who's going to do what? And then talk about, you know, your own journey to get to the point of actually being able to put a presentation forward, a symposium.
You're asking for a lot of secrets there, Daz.
Sorry. Well, you know, tell us the bits.
I don't know that I want to give you the recipe for the secret sauce, man.
I'll tell you a little bit.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I don't want to know everything, just the minor details.
All right. So as you mentioned, we always try to announce the title and obviously the dates for the event at the symposium the year before. So for example, we already know what that's going to be, myself and the symposium co-chair, John Eric Gillow. So we are already thinking about who we might want to ask for keynote speakers. And then generally we will ask our members if they have ideas for topics that they might want to present related to the theme. And we'll go through those ideas and have an internal discussion and then kind of go from there. And there are certain things that we're always looking to balance, and maybe we'll also read our event surveys and see if people had certain requests at the previous year and if maybe there's a way we can work with that. And you know, that feedback is really important because for a year or two we had skipped the panel discussions. Well, we got a lot of feedback in 2021 that people wanted the panel discussions. So this is where we bring several members or several historians together. Questions come from the audience. We'll also have questions from our moderator. And then there's a discussion that happens right there in front of the room very publicly. And you know, people really liked that a lot more than John, Eric, and I had guessed they did. So we've brought that back by popular demand. So we do try to keep the interests of the audience in mind as we're planning an event. Another thing that John, Eric, and I are always thinking about is what's working, what's not. If something's working, do we want to improve it or do we want to leave it status quo for another year or two? So those are some of the things that we think about as we're planning the next year's event.
Yeah. And, you know, there's kind of a financial aspect. Nobody will ever like to talk about this. If you talk to anybody else who runs a seminar, symposium, yeah, whatever, they'll never say this. We got to have butts and seats, right? You know, we've got 144 tickets that we need to sell. And so what topic is going to put butts in seats? What speakers are going to help put butts in seats? How do we balance that versus our desire to also provide a platform for people to try doing presentations for the first time, giving new people a voice, trying out new talent. You know, if you follow some of our reader surveys, we could have a symposium that has nothing but Matt Atkinson and Chris Kowalkowski and Chris White and just have those three guys speak over, you know. But we want to give other people a chance to talk as well. And so just kind of balancing who spoke last year, who's got a great topic. And, you know, there's just a lot of mix that goes into that.
Yeah. So. Okay, cool. And what about you guys? So obviously, Chris, you've had the radio background and you've done, you know, other stuff. But Sarah, so what was it like doing the presentation for the first time for you, Sarah, say, for instance? Was it a nerve-wracking experience for you or?
Well, fortunately, I had been doing presentations to Civil War roundtables for a few years before my first time speaking at an emerging Civil War symposium. But any time you get up in front of a room with that many people in it, I still get butterflies in my stomach. there was one very embarrassing year where my nervous reaction was my eyes would water as though I was crying. People have seen it. It was filmed. It's been on national television. It's very embarrassing.
For crying.
Yes, it looks like I'm crying and I was introducing Chris Makowski.
It makes a lot of people cry.
It makes sense, don't it?
Yeah, it does. That makes sense.
So you never know what's going to happen, you know, when you get up there. But there are certainly things that I've learned to do over time. I always like to be prepared beforehand. I now have goals of, you know, certain deadlines that I have to meet if I'm giving a presentation so that I've, you know, gone through it and checked certain things. I've worked on my timing, that sort of stuff. It doesn't always mean it's going to go perfectly according to what was rehearsed, but I do have a process that I like to work with on that. In fact, I'm working, I've been doing some of that earlier this evening before we got on this call, getting ready for my presentation this year. So I do find that having a bit of a routine and being familiar with what I'm talking about certainly helps a lot.
And I think it probably helps when you're passionate about that subject, though, because it makes it easier, probably.
It does. And the other thing is knowing far more about it than you're actually going to say in the presentation. And that's where, for me, I'm always working on my timing and my pacing, because it's so easy to add everything that you know. But, you know, tonight, one of the things I was working on was paring down what's important. What do I need to get across for these arguments that I'm making for your listeners or watchers? If you're not familiar, our theme this year is What If? And it's taking historical scenarios that we have facts for, but then asking a question about it, kind of a what if question there. So we're not doing what if the Confederates had lightsabers or anything crazy like that. But we've got some really great what ifs that are really going to get some good discussion going. So kind of back to that idea, just being really familiar with the topic does give that speaker the confidence to get up there. And, you know, also it's not just about what you say in the presentation, but you got to be ready for the Q&A. And knowing lots of background is really helpful. And the other thing is, for me, and I always remind myself of this, it is better to say, I don't know, than to give an answer that everybody knows you don't know. So, you know, there's been times that's happened, you know, at the symposium, at other programs that I've given, and you just have to say that's a great question. I don't know. I would love to research that and get back to you.
Yeah.
One thing I'll add about that too, though, is like passion isn't enough, because we've all heard speakers who are like super passionate, so they want to tell you everything they know, and then their presentations are a hot mess. So passion doesn't always translate to good public speaking skills. I think still having, you know, a command of inflection and pacing and eye contact and volume and all those mechanics of public speaking, I think, are really important. And then comes that organizational component. You know, are you making a clear argument? Are you backing it up clearly? Are you providing just the relevant information, as Sarah said? And then I know some people who do all of that stuff and they're super passionate, and then their passion doesn't come through and they're like boring as all get out. And it's just like, oh, please, let's see some of that passion. I know you love this stuff. Let it come through.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's always such a challenge, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Carry on, mate. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. Go ahead.
Cool. Okay. Just quickly, it's a bit of a shame because I'll bring it up anyway. I know it's not happening this year, but just quickly tell us about C-SPAN and how that comes about. Because, I mean, it puts you on national TV.
And that was a big step for us, you know, when we called them up and we're like, hey, we've got the symposium, want to come film it? And they're like, yes. At the time, they had three channels going with content. They had 48 hours of history program with a specific Civil War slot. They have pared that down by half and they've gotten rid of their Civil War slot. So that's why they're not coming this year. They're just doing less. And then last year they also did a big buyout, and I think like a half of their staff took these buyouts. Or maybe it was only a third of the staff. I don't want to provide incorrect information there, but a large portion of their staff took these buyouts. They scaled down their workforce, scaled down their programming. So that's not why they're not coming. But, you know, at first there were some questions like, we're on C-SPAN. People aren't going to buy tickets. They're not going to come. Turned out to not be a problem. Stuff was on C-SPAN, and we still have been selling the symposium out because there's so much that goes on in person that C-SPAN is not able to capture. I think the year that we don't sell out and C-SPAN would show up might be the year that we would stop having C-SPAN.
Well, that's not going to happen. Yeah, because again, I know from my personal experience, and I haven't actually managed to make it there yet, and I will do it one day, hopefully in a couple of weeks. And is being in that, is being around all those, you know, very influential people, you know, and seeing them and talking to them and interacting with them in person.
Yeah, but it's cool, like, you know, Sarah, and I know you've had this experience where people, you know, you go off to speak at a roundtable someplace and they're like, oh, I saw you on C-SPAN, you know, and this allowed us to reach audiences that we otherwise wouldn't reach.
Absolutely. And the other thing, and this is just kind of a funny personal story, I don't have a television. So I've certainly seen the videos online when C-SPAN posts them, but I don't always know when they're running the program or rerunning it. So the general clue that, oh, they must be rerunning one of my speeches is I'll get random text messages from people that I haven't heard from in 3 years, or there'll suddenly be a whole bunch of messages that I get through my website. And it's like, okay, I guess they just reran the Chambersburg program or something like that. So it is interesting, the connections that are made, and I generally have no idea it's even happening, but always happy for the feedback.
Yeah. It cracks me up because like people, they love to take a picture of me on their TV and then send me a picture of me on their TV. Look at what I'm watching this morning. There's nothing better to watch on your TV.
There was one friend, they called my parents up and they're like, Sarah's on TV. And my parents were like, well, was it good or was it bad? And they're like, no, she's talking. Like, it's a history program. And they're like, oh, okay.
Brilliant. Okay, let's just quickly talk about 2020, because I know we're fed up with talking about that, to be honest with you. But unfortunately, it didn't happen, did it? And but you took the steps and went, do you know what? We're doing it anyway. And you did it online and it went fantastic, didn't it?
It did. We had a really good time. In fact, it was so successful that C-SPAN actually had us do a second one exclusively for them. So we ended up creating two different virtual symposia that year. And, you know, there you've got a picture where, you know, Kevin Pollak is speaking. Chris White, with his mask on, is videotaping it for us. C-SPAN then took those feeds and put it up and used our content. And so it was a chance for us to still do something, still reach out to our folks, still give some of our people the opportunity to do some presentations. And it was a chance for us to work with C-SPAN as one of our partners.
Okay. So let's talk about this year's quickly. By the time this goes out, I would imagine all the tickets would have been sold out. But anyway, just tell us.
I will say we will weasel somebody in if they want to get in and they're here for this podcast. Okay.
Fair enough.
Weasel you in.
Nice. Yeah, it's good to, you know, if you know people in high places. But let's talk about the theme quickly and what you can expect to see at the symposium this year.
Sure. Chris, do you want to kind of give the rationale on the theme, and then I'll share who we've got coming?
Sure. Years ago, I had written a pair of posts for the blog about what if Stonewall Jackson had survived his wounding, because people ask me that all the time when I'm out doing tours of Chancellorsville. And, you know, they like to jump to the assumption that if he somehow survives, he shows up in Gettysburg and the Confederates win the battle. And so I really like to, like, let's back that up a little bit and let's deconstruct this and what's going on the ground and what would it take for him to even survive and what would happen if he did. And all right, let's talk about Gettysburg. But, you know, so like it proves to be really fertile ground to discuss the events of what actually happened, rather than like, well, if he showed up at Gettysburg, this would happen in this day. You know, we don't know. He could have got stung by a bee and died from an allergic reaction. There's no way to tell. So like, let's use the question as a chance to really focus us in on the facts of what's happening in that moment and the assumptions that we make. It tells us a lot about ourselves. So I'm just fascinated by this idea of like, But what if can allow us to talk about how it can help us better understand what actually happened without getting into the wishful thinking that people like to engage in about, well, you know, what they wanted to really have happen. And so that was the basis for our book. That's the basis for volume two that we're working on right now. And it's going to be the basis for the symposium is how can the question, what if, help us focus on what actually happened and what assumptions we make when we ask that question. Sir.
Exactly. And with that concept in mind, we've tried to address a variety of topics. So the 2022 Emerging Civil War Symposium will be August 5th through 7th at Stevenson Ridge at Spotsylvania, Virginia. And this year, our keynote speaker is Gary Edelman with American Battlefield Trust. And for those that know Gary, you'll probably have a pretty good guess of what he's going to talk about. He's going to have fun with Gettysburg, What If. Gettysburg.
What enough room to swing his arms about? That's the main thing.
Sorry, I'm doing my Gary in the background here.
Sorry, Sarah.
No worries. So Gary will be leading us on Friday night with some Gettysburg what ifs, and then our other speakers through the weekend. I think we've got them in alphabetical order here on the list I'm looking at. So I'll be presenting about the Battle of Cedar Creek and exploring the idea: what if Phil Sheridan didn't arrive? So working on that, Neil Chatelain will be talking about the ambitions and challenges of a Confederate Navy European ironclad squadron. So we'll get into some technology and certainly some Navy work there as well. Phil Greenwalt is going to be exploring the what if of a Confederate Western Empire. And Zachary Fry is joining us. He's a newer addition to our list, and I'm sorry, I don't have in front of me what he is speaking about. But
he's going to talk about what if Meade had attacked Lee along the Potomac after Gettysburg.
Right. I knew it was Gettysburg campaign related, but I didn't want to misspeak. So thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. Brian Matthew Jordan, who helped Chris edit the What If book, is going to be doing an in-depth look at that concept of what if and what it can help us learn when used effectively in the history field. Gordon Ray, who is the top historian on the Overland campaign, will be exploring the six great what ifs of the Overland campaign. John Tracy, who serves as our editorial committee chairman, is going to be looking at the realities of Civil War medicine and exploring a what if it wasn't as bad as we think it is. And then last but not least on our alphabetical list here, Chris White is going to be tackling that big question, what if Stonewall Jackson had not been shot? Mm-hmm. And then also throughout the weekend, we're going to have two panels doing panel discussions, and one will be focusing on the great what ifs, and another panel will focus on the what ifs of the Maryland campaign in 1862. So we've got a wide variety of topics, and we're really looking forward to sharing these ideas and seeing the discussions that come out of them.
Nice. I'm really looking forward to this. So what would your message, guys, be to people that are out there that are thinking of writing articles or sending them in and or getting involved in the history field, you know, that haven't already? What would your message be?
Sure. So I can start. If someone's interested in doing some writing for the Emerging Civil War blog, first of all, take the step. We welcome it. I would go back to the point that I made a little bit earlier. Read some of the articles that are on the blog. Get a feel for the different styles that we use. Give them a second proofread on your own before you send them on in. And definitely review the submission guidelines that are posted on our website, because that will really help you see what the editorial committee is looking for as far as formatting, word count, and those sorts of things. That's a really easy way to get some brownie points starting off. But definitely check out the submission guidelines, submit an article. Again, we're always trying to make sure that we stay accessible and friendly, and it's something we're always revisiting. How can we make it easier for people to reach out, for people to work with us? So that would be my encouragement, is if you're thinking about writing an article, check out those submission guidelines and definitely send it on in.
Cool. Yeah. I'm going to say, first of all, do it well, and then do it better. Digital technology lets anybody do it. You can live the dream. If you're excited and passionate, do it, you know, but then do it really well, because there's a lot of competition out there. And so what's going to differentiate you from all the other fanboys or fangirls is the fact that you're producing really good, solid content. And then I would say, do it better. What can you then do to take you to the next level? And so this is going to, I think, involve more than just, you know, being passionate about history, but being savvy about marketing. You know, how do you make your voice heard among all that other cacophony of noise? It's going to require a conscientiousness about mechanics and writing, you know, even if that ties into your promotional materials or whatever you're creating online, you know, as far as writing, even if it's promotional messages or actual articles, you know, your mechanics have to be good, your grammar, your punctuation, all those things that make writing good and effective, organization, things like that. So do it well, and then do it better.
There you go. Thank you, Chris. Just so before we finish this up, I just want to say what Emergency War has done for me, you know, and influenced me. So, you know, it's influenced me as a historian quite massively. You know, I read a lot of your blog posts. I watch a lot of your content, you know. So I'd like to thank you for that. But for me, it's made it more accessible to everyone. Social media has also helped, you know, give so many other people opportunities in this talent, you know, whether that be writing, podcasting, YouTube, in articles, whatever. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think did it really well in that you created this brand for yourself, this platform for yourself. And then what can you do to do it better? And like you reached out to me out of the blue and then you said,
yes, that's right.
You said like the worst I could do is say no, you know? And so like developing a relationship has been, I think, really important.
Yeah.
And so those are all things that people can do to kind of bump up their game.
Yeah. And so that, and going back to what you were saying earlier, Sarah, about cringing about some early stuff, I do that with a lot of my stuff. Yeah.
Don't we all?
Yes, it's like, oh, God, I didn't say that. Anyway.
It's really weird, though, because, like, once upon a time, like, you know, like, I'm just some schmo, you know, or, like, Sarah's just some schmo. And, like, we created this platform to create opportunities for ourselves, and we worked hard, and we were conscientious about our branding and our product. We want to make sure we have to, you know, like, it's weird because people are like, oh, yeah, you're Chris Mikulski. It's like, I was just some schmo. So hopefully, you know, if there's someone who's listening or watching and they think, well, gosh, can I do that? Well, we did it, you know, and you can do it too.
Yeah. And that's where we'll leave that thought, ladies and gentlemen. So thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Dan.
No problem.
Thank you.